Welcome to another episode of Meenal's World, and this week I have the lovely Manjeet Gill from Binti International here with me today. We talk about how we can change the narrative around periods and how we can get everybody involved to make sure that every girl has dignity. Binti were the first period charity in the UK and in India, and we have an incredible conversation about how Manjeet has worked so hard to create a change and make sure that we create generational change as well, and no woman should be left without menstruation products, not just in the UK but around the world as well. So I want to thank Manjeet for her time, because she's a very busy woman and she's helped me personally so much throughout the last few months with my own protesting as well. Manjeet is an inspiration, and when I grow up I hope to be like her. But she did say that when she grows up she hopes to be like me, so we'll see how that goes, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. After coronavirus, and we were supposed to speak to you, well, about 7 months ago, weren't we? And it was just the day after Boris Johnson had said lockdown, and we had to postpone everything. So it's really nice to have you here, although we have been in touch for the last few months, especially during the pandemic. But how does it feel to get back into some sort of normality?
Well, I guess firstly, I'm quite amazed that I'm sitting in the same room as you.
Yeah.
And that you're on the other end talking to me about what I've done with Binti, because what you've done in the past 6 months is ginormous and
well,
should be
Well, that's
recognized.
The thing, Manjeet, you know, this is something I did want to like just tell our listeners as well, is that I couldn't have done anything without you, because do you remember my first protest? I remember calling you up saying, Manjeet, I don't think I should do this. I'm too afraid to go out and protest outside Downing Street, because I didn't think that it would actually have any impact. But you just said to me, just listen to your heart, and if you feel it's right, then go for it. And I feel like that's been sort of your motto throughout your whole life. Like, if it feels right in your heart, just go for it. And I guess that's what started Binti as well.
Well, my parents named me Manjeet, or Manjeet, and that essentially means follow your heart, right?
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Overcome your mind and follow your heart. So I guess I guess growing up, my motto in my life has always been, where there's a will, there's a way.
Mm.
So if I want to do it, I will do it.
Yeah.
And I don't take no for an answer.
Yeah, I know that. But Manjeet, I read that you were involved with about 7 different startups before fully committing your time to this.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing before Binti kicked off?
So I've always been in business development.
Right.
I worked at an international level. But I started off selling double glazing back in the day.
Yeah.
So I'm used to people saying no. In fact, I know that if someone says no to me 100 times, that the next time will be the time that one person says yes. So I know how to find, I can find anything anywhere. You know, I'm that old school, used to get a telephone book and a telephone, and that was it, and we had to go and sell whatever we were selling.
Yeah. So it sounds a bit like Alan Sugar's story.
It kind of is. But I'm younger than him.
Much yeah.
Than him. Yeah. So it's that. And I think it was just, I also remember every single organization that I worked for, I either needed a sexy product or I needed a sexy organization to work for.
Mm.
You know, because that's how you make your money,
yeah.
Right? If you've got a good support system behind you. But I would like to say, with my hand on my heart, Binti and talking about periods is actually the sexiest thing I've ever done.
Well, I met you for the first time in London when you had a workshop.
Oh, yes, I remember now.
That was the first time we properly met, but mm-hmm. We were talking over the phone and staying in touch before that. And actually, Manjeet, I don't know if you know this, but I've been following you for years now. When I was a medical student in Prague, I always used to tell myself that one day when I get to the UK, I can. This is something I want to get involved in. It's because I was so far away, I wasn't really sure what I could do. But then to finally be there that day was like a really like great moment for me. Like, finally, I can get my hands dirty now with Binti, and then obviously lockdown happened, so you know, here we are. But what happened for you to say, you know what, I'm going to put what I've been doing to the side, and I'm just going to focus my energy and time on Binti? Was it something that happened to you specifically, or something you saw?
So I guess in 2005, I think it was, I had a massive car accident.
Right.
and I smashed my calcaneum, which is like my heel bone, and I fractured my femur. And it was in Exeter when they put me back together again, the NHS. They put in a pin that was too big, and they kind of just mashed my foot back and put it into a plaster. So it's called a conservative approach to healing. But it took me 7 surgeries and another 5 years to learn how to walk again.
Really?
Yeah, and that was kind of the age where I turned from my 30s into my 40s.
Yeah.
So, you know, that 5-year period, like I was wearing jogging bottoms every day or whatever, or wearing comfortable clothes, I kind of just lost who I was. Because I came from a very sales high-end background where I'd be wearing nice clothes, driving cars, blah, blah, blah.
That's kind of how I feel right now, Manjeet, being a new mother.
The time will fly. You don't even know where I went. And I guess at that time, I learned how to walk again. That was a big thing. So I'd started looking at what I wanted to do next.
So during this time, you stopped working?
I stopped working. I couldn't work because I couldn't walk. Right. But I did have Aaron.
Okay.
So that was the only thing that I could do. And I had a, do you know what an Elizaroff frame is?
I guess it's a walking aid?
It's like, you know how you sometimes might see someone with a broken leg and they've got the outside is like, oh God.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Right. So Aaron learned how to walk by holding my frame.
Oh, right. How old is Aaron?
Well, I fit him in because I was told that I was going to have surgery at this end and then I was going to have surgery at that end. And if I wanted to have a baby, I'd have it in the middle.
So wait, you had this accident and you were pregnant at the time?
No, okay. I had to become pregnant at the time because I knew that if I didn't have my baby and during that time, I would never have had him.
Right. Okay, fine.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So
it was a planned. Yeah, I was going to have him, or I was planning to have a baby before the accident. And then I had the accident, and then I knew that the next few years of my life was going to be buggered with surgeries and stuff. So then I decided that I needed to fit him in.
Right, okay, fine.
So it was planned.
So you had the surgery, and then you were obviously dealing with a newborn as well.
Yeah, so I had 7 surgeries.
How did you do that? Because, I mean, I'm fit and healthy in, like, medical terms, and I've got my newborn at home, and I can barely even...
Sorry, you were pregnant with a baby, and you were campaigning outside Downing Street, so it's kind of the same thing. You just got to do what you got to do, right?
Yeah, I guess you get, like, this switch in your head where you're just on this mode of go, go, go. Mm. I mean, if I look back now, a year ago, I was just thinking about this when I was driving here. So a year ago, I would never thought I would be heavily pregnant protesting outside Downing Street and then doing all of these
and in the Vogue magazine, come on, let's just talk about the flashy bits as well, right?
But I never thought I'd be there, but it was a point of just, you know, you get that switch in your head and you just like, it's either this or nothing. And I guess that was your mentality as well.
Yeah, but it's one of those switches that you switch on when you're quite, or somebody switches it on when you're quite young,
yeah,
and then you never really switch it off until you decide to. Right? Your switch come off? It's
no,
not off, is it?
No, it's always just, on.
Yeah, it's always on.
But I feel like I just put it up a gear
over
the last few months.
Yeah, because you have to, because you need to get over the hill
that
you're trying to climb.
Yeah. So you had this accident, and then you're going through all these surgeries. And then was that when you decided to say, okay, I want to find a different initiative in my life?
I was trying to work out what I wanted to do next, but I found that... While I was doing that, I started travelling again because I had a little spurt where I wasn't able to travel so much. And I remember that one year I'd gone to Dubai, and I was in Dubai and I could see women, like really beautiful looking women, and they were covered in top to head in their burqas. And I could even smell them as they walked past, and I could see their shiny red toes and things, right? Yeah. And then I went to Thailand and I could see these young girls with, they've still got their baby fat, dancing on dance poles. Mm. And there's just a part of me that I was just, you know, we go through so much, right, as women to deal with just the normal stuff. So I'd given birth. Yeah, I wasn't feeling sorry for myself, but I knew I had to fit him in. So I'd given birth and I was looking up opportunities for myself, and suddenly the world seemed a little bit more restrictive.
Mm.
So I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but as I was looking at what other women were doing. And I guess I was just getting this feeling of unfairness.
And so you felt like the world was unfair to some women?
That women work so hard in all of in everything that they did, and they had to do twice as much as men do to get anywhere in life. Right.
Did you feel that in your business industry as well?
Well, in my business industry, I guess the reflection on that is there was only about 5% women in the sales world. I remember when I was, can't remember what the company was. I think it was Cable and Wireless. We were selling cable television. There were 100 salesmen, and there were 5 women. And the 5 women, we were always in the top 10 sales numbers. So I've come from a very male-dominated space.
But did you ever feel that, not only because you were female in a male-dominated space, but also as a South Asian woman as well, did you feel like that friction as well? Or
if I did, I chose to ignore it. Because I didn't let it become me. I think men have a much more difficult time in terms of moving up the ladder. And they're seen by the colour of their skin than women do. I think this is my experience. And I know, because I guess now the conversation is, well, did me being brown have any restrictions on me?
Yeah.
And I don't think it did in the outside world. Obviously it did on the inside world, right? With family and stuff. And all the wings that were clipped.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I think I often think about where it started, but it was all of these, this idea that we live in a restricted world, right? So then I started mentoring this young lady with the Sherry Blair Foundation. Mm-hmm. She was someone in Nairobi. She'd set up her own little shop and she was struggling to work out how to run the business. So we used to speak every week on Skype on a Saturday. And despite the miles, our lives seemed quite similar until one day she said to me, "Manjit, do you know that women in Africa don't have access to period products?"
How did your lives seem similar?
Well, she was running a business. She drove a car. You know, she lived in a modern world. It wasn't that she lived in like a rural village. Yeah. She came from a rural village, but she went to university. So there was similarities in that sense.
Yeah.
And I think if I look back at all of those things that happened, this idea that women don't have access to period products, you know, that one time in the month where maybe I could have been vulnerable, I'm not obviously, but if I had been, I know I wouldn't have done anything if I didn't have a pad.
Mm.
And that was what sparked this.
So it was
thing.
Just that one conversation, that one thing that she said to you
that
made you think, I need to do something about it.
And it wasn't that I actually thought I need to do something about it. I just started doing some research.
Right.
And then I never stopped.
And you still haven't stopped. You're still going. But when you had this conversation with this lady in Nairobi, it must have been a sort of moment for you where you thought, actually, a lot of women in this world are suffering to some extent. I mean, it is something that is put upon us by nature or by science, and then we have to deal with this every single month. And it's not a case of, you know,
every day of our lives.
And every day of our lives, yeah. And I think the conversation I want to have with you today, Manjit, is that we know, I mean, and I hope my listeners as well and everyone who's tuning in already is aware of the lack of products available in developing countries. But what shocked me the most when I spoke to you is even in developed countries like the UK, there are certain obstacles that women face in having access to these products. So I'm very afraid to use the word sanitary products in front of you because you're not a big fan of that. You don't like the word sanitary.
Well, if you have a pad or a tampon, then there's nothing unsanitary about it, right?
Yeah.
We have to get away from the language that we use that continually perpetuates the stigma and the shame.
Mm.
So that's why it should be menstrual products or period products.
Yeah. And, you know, your tagline for Binti is every woman deserves dignity, period.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say that? Like, what did is it something that you feel people need to know about? Because do you feel like women are put into a sort of shell during those 4 or 5 days, or, well, every day? Do you think that women are treated differently because they menstruate?
You know, it's kind of one of those times in my life where when we started the organization, I pulled together a number of my friends and we used to brainstorm. Like, we brainstormed the name. We brainstormed the term dignity and period, right? When I started this work, the only information you found about periods or menstruation when you looked online was either about Murugan, the guy who invented the low-cost pad machine, or there was a few stats, and that was it.
Hmm.
And you had the incorrect definition of menstruation in the Oxford Dictionary. it's still the incorrect definition.
Really?
Yeah.
What is it, the definition?
A period or a menstruation is when a woman who is having a sexual relationship starts bleeding once a month.
Really? That's the definition of it?
Mm-hmm. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
I mean, what about all the girls that don't have sex and they start their period at 9?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What about until they do start having sex? That could be 20 years, 15 years, 10 years.
Mm.
So, yes, it's absolutely wrong. But anyway, the point I was trying to make was there just wasn't anything. So when we started looking at the terminology we were going to use, it was to make sure that everything was dignified, right? We weren't going to go in and start screaming bloody good periods or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because we came from a world where language was really important.
Were you afraid of alienating people during this time? Because obviously men probably feel afraid to even talk about these things. And, you know, even talking to my own father and to say, like, I need products from the supermarket. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'll get them for me, but I can just see he's very, very uncomfortable. So were you aware, were you trying to create language to sort of make it as inclusive as possible?
Language is really important right from the beginning, because I suppose I come from a sales background, and I know that if I'm going to sell something, I need to make sure that my audience is going to hear every single word that I want them to hear. So the conversation I would have with men is very different to one that I would have with women, or to kids, or to girls, or to boys, or age, mm-hmm. you know, even our elderly, the different communities. So language is there right from the beginning. And going back to your question, why do we say every girl deserves dignity, period? In the beginning, I thought to myself, if we can create impact just for one girl, then I know what we're doing is right.
Mm-hmm.
And someone, I think one of our comms person said, yeah, but what about all the other girls? I said, look, every decision we make as an organization has to impact this girl, whoever that girl is. And if we keep that in focus with everything, then it really helped us channel out the things that weren't important. You know,
like what, for example?
So, for example, are we going to spend £15 for getting a poster on the wall? How is that going to help every girl deserves dignity, period? So all of those decisions, from how many products we were going to buy, the kind of language we were going to use in our education program to make sure that it could cover conversation that we'd have a girl in a rural village in India versus a rural village in Wales or even in London. It's all about that one person, you know, because if you bring it down to that one person, how are you going to impact her life? That's kind of where it comes from.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And even the word dignity, right? What does menstruating with dignity mean?
Yeah.
It means so many different things to different people.
Mm.
But for us, it's about ensuring that she has access to whatever product that she feels is going to help her menstruate with as little restriction as possible.
Mm. And not feel afraid or...
Mm. If she wants to use a tampon in a community where they don't insert things, that's her choice to menstruate with dignity.
It's funny you talk about tampons, Majid, because I remember when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I used to go to the beach with my friends, and I remember when it was my time of the month, I would say, oh, I can't come for the next week. So I just tell my friends, like, I'll see you in a couple of weeks now. And they'd be like, why? I was like, well, I've got my period. Clearly can't come to the beach when you've got your period. And they were like, haven't you heard of a tampon? And I was like, what is that? So they told me all about it. And then I went home and I told my mum about it. And she just seemed terrified of the idea of inserting a tampon in that area to help you with your period. So you come from a Sikh background as well. And I'm sure that you must have faced a lot of backlash, or, you know, a lot of questioning from your community, maybe even your own family. How did you get through all of that? Because that's something that I feel has happened. I feel like for me, it's been more concentrated over the last few months, because what I've done has been quite extreme in some sense. I struggle to deal with the questioning and why are you doing it? And even, you know, even things like, but you will make a difference. You're one person. Who's going to listen to you? And all these questions start coming in. And this is why before my protest, I called you and I said, Manjeet, look, I'm just getting all these phone calls and everyone is saying it's not a good idea. But you just said that one thing to me, which is, if you feel it's right, just do it.
Mm.
And I know your sales background must have helped you quite a lot. But what was it like to try and, I wouldn't say convince, but try to explain yourself to people from our community?
Let's put our community to the side for just a second. But in terms of, if you ask anybody living in London, do we have shame around periods? And the first reaction is always, well, oh, we don't have period shame. But yet we stick period products up our sleeves.
Mm.
Or we use blue liquid to show the absorbency of period products. So just getting people to believe that this problem actually exists is probably the only issue I faced. Because if it doesn't, if you've never seen that poverty around periods, or you've never not had access, then you can't imagine someone's life and them not having access.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the biggest issue. Even as a Sikh woman running an organization wanting to impact different communities, I always knew that. Well, actually, I didn't even know that there was an issue in the Sikh community. I just believed, because I've never been restricted by anything
so
around
you
my periods.
Were you raised in quite a liberal
household? No, no, no. I was very... sorry, about periods.
Oh, about periods specifically.
There was nothing that I wasn't allowed to do because I was on my period.
Yeah.
Right. And I think I was quite shocked and taken aback when I started hearing girls saying to me that they didn't go to the Gurdwara, or they couldn't perform certain things when they're in the
mm-hmm,
Gurdwara.
Mm-hmm.
Not all Sikh women can do all Sikh seva.
Yeah.
Is fundamentally what it boils down to. And I think when you believe something from your heart and you have the passion, I know that what I'm doing is teaching girls about periods. There is absolutely nothing that I'm saying that is wrong. Because even the conversation around periods, why do we have the shame around periods? Because we talk about sex. We know that as soon as a girl starts having a period, she could get pregnant and she could, you know, she's going to have sex and she could get pregnant. And that's why we don't talk about it to our children.
Yeah.
Even in our community, right? That's the main thing. So what do you do if you want to have that conversation? Well, we don't even need to talk about sex. I go into villages around the world and I talk about periods, and we don't have this conversation about sex. I don't tell a girl that until your egg is fertilized, you will bleed every
month.
But
that's how they educate children in school.
It's wrong.
About periods. Because when I learned about it, I think... So this was the issue with me, was that I learned about periods in school after I got my period.
I know, crazy.
You know, I was like, well, I was in year 7.
Did you think you were dying?
Yeah, I was. So, you know, I know it's something that you talk about with Binti, which is like everyone has a very crazy period story. But I had really bad cramps for a good month. And my mom just kept trying to put the conversation to the side, like, oh, it's just stomach cramps, you must have eaten something bad or whatever. And it was only when I realized that I was bleeding when I said to my mom, like, I think there's something wrong. And even then, I still didn't know what a period was. I thought that I would be bleeding every single day for the rest of my life. It was only the year later in school when they started talking about it that I realized why we have periods and what goes on. So I think the education system in itself is flawed. And it's something that we need to change. And I know that's something that you're very involved in as well.
But so how do you, as a gynecologist or somebody coming from the medical field, right?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the conversation when I say to you, we should be teaching girls that if their egg isn't fertilized, that their period starts? How do you feel about just saying that one day this will help you to have babies, but every month the blood comes and this is where it comes from, and keeping that sex conversation away? What do you think about that?
I think that's really important, Minji, because I feel like there's, you know, if you create that disconnect and that gap, it's not as daunting for girls. I mean, I can't imagine at the age of 10 or 11 someone telling me about being pregnant. I mean, it's scary, right? You think that, I mean, you think that the fact that you're already bleeding is scary enough. And then to add that narrative into that is just not right, I think.
Well, sometimes some communities celebrate and say, you're a woman now.
Yeah.
You're a woman at 9. It's like, what is that all about?
Yeah.
How is that
ever
going to
empower
them?
Like, I've seen in India, for example, they have these celebrations that, oh, now she's a woman. But then they hide her in a shed.
No, but
when they're menstruating.
Let's go back to that, what you just said, when they celebrate that she's now a woman. It's because they're showing her fertility and how ready she is.
Mm.
You know, they're basically selling their daughter. It's not a celebration. Let's look at all the reasons for why they celebrate. Is any one of them there to really empower that girl to finish her education and have a good life?
Yeah.
It's not, is it?
Yeah.
It's all about, I've got a daughter and she can get married.
How can you change this narrative to empower women and say having a period is something, as you say, to have dignity? How can you change that narrative?
It's just through continuous education and awareness, and maybe we can't change the conversations with the generations gone behind, although I'm not afraid of that, and I'll always...
Well, you're not afraid of anything, Mandeen.
I'll always try and have that So, like, if I was going into a village, right, and in order for me to speak to the girls, I go for the mother-in-laws or the bibis first.
Yeah.
Because if I get their buy-in, I can talk to anyone.
Mm.
No one can get in the way.
It's a generational thing, isn't it?
It's a generational thing. You've got to get that permission. Right?
Yeah.
So, and those women... I've had some amazing stories. And, yeah, they sit there with their feet up on the table and they're like, what do you mean they want sanitary pads? In our days, we used rags and everything was fine. And then you say, yeah, but what about when you didn't have a rag? What did you do?
Yeah.
And I remember this one lady, and she was the most funniest woman I've ever met in my life because she was stern, straight, didn't want to talk about anything. But after she heard the other girls speaking, she said, oh, I went to a wedding once when I was 20-something and I didn't have anything. So I went into the kitchen, the rasoi, I went into the kitchen and they had a kitchen towel. It was a white, brand new one.
A white one? Oh, no.
And she took it, she used it, and she felt so naughty.
Yeah.
But she was so proud of herself because she was able to...
remove that fear and just say, this is what I need and I'm going to use it.
And she laughed so hard, and she had everyone else laugh so hard because she was the strict mother-in-law and the daughter-in-laws were sitting around her and they were like absolutely horrified that the mother-in-law had been naughty at some point in her life. So, but it's that, it's every girl, woman has a good, bad or an ugly period story.
Mm.
And if you can start sharing them, we have conversations with people where the room is completely quiet and as soon as you start sharing your own story, then everybody opens up.
Mm. But you know, the thing that I find very fascinating, Manjeet, is that you have started something that is so broad in a sense. I mean, you've gone mainly all over the world really to talk about periods, and in different countries they have different languages and different tribes and different cultures. So when you started this, did you ever imagine you'd be at this stage now?
So in our first year, we were at Canary Wharf. We're in the shopping centres. There's three shopping centres, and we had a stand at each one for like a period of 3 months. And I remember standing there, and they paid for our stand. We had stickers on the ground. And I was standing there thinking, oh, my God, I'm in the financial district of the world talking about periods.
Mm.
Like, what am I going to do next? Like, I couldn't imagine anything bigger or better than that.
Yeah.
And plus, we had people coming up to us in suits and saying, do you know that your signage, it looks like you're talking about periods or something.
You're like, we are.
You might want to consider that.
Yeah.
And the conversations we had were brilliant because it was the first time we were face-to-face with Londoners talking about periods, and the conversations were mad, you know, from men not knowing what a period was.
Well, you said, I want to ask, like, men in suits, right, who you would think are very well informed and educated. Mm. Were there people at that time who just didn't know what a period was or didn't understand?
Most men don't understand what a period is. That's the truth, isn't it? Unless they have a wife who they listen to and she's told them everything. But
if not, you think men, well, you know, at least I won't say you think because you've seen it yourself, but men just don't understand what a period is and why it happens.
And there's so many, actually, you say that the conversation about periods, I never use the word broad. I would say that it's like a 360 thing. I don't talk about anything else because it is so broad.
Yeah, yeah.
The men might know that you bleed every month, right? But some men don't know that some men think you can stop your blood, like you can hold your pee in. So why
really?
Is it, why do you need to worry about having access to a period product?
Wow.
Some men think you might bleed for 5 days. They don't understand you might bleed for 2 or 1 or 4 or 7. Mm.
You're saying that, and I go back to medical school. Even in medical school, men or boys at that time, they didn't understand what period was.
But why would they, right? They've never even touched a period.
But even going through the anatomy of female, like that's what we're taught in medical school. I think there are some men, and I'm not pointing fingers, but I'm just saying that because it's not associated with their life, they just switch off.
Well, if you think of, I'm going to use the word penis, right? Yeah. Penis hangs out.
You can use a P word, Manjeet, that's all right.
It hangs out of the body.
Yeah.
Even a woman knows what a penis looks like, even though she may never have actually seen one, right? Yeah. She can imagine it. But when it's the vulva or the uterus or the vagina, and you know, it's all internal. So the only external bit that a man might see is that plastic bag sitting in a bathroom cupboard, that thing they would never touch, right? Because it's sanitary.
Well, why do you think specifically it's very important to bring males into this conversation? Because I've seen the team at Binti and I've seen the ambassadors. There are also male ambassadors and people involved with helping your charity. Why do you think it's just as important to have men in this conversation?
To be honest, when I first started, I wasn't really thinking about the men. And I remember one of my early conversations with a friend. We sat down, it was him, his brother, and I had one of my female friends. And his brother went into this massive conversation about how every month his life was miserable because his wife was on her period.
Yeah.
And all I remember was my blood was boiling and I was thinking, it's not about you, it's about her. And maybe you should consider why she's feeling like that.
Yeah.
And then my friend said to me after the meeting, he's like, you know, you're not going to get very far if you don't take the men into the same conversation. And it took me some time to understand that in order to create lasting change, you've got to have every person at the table, right? From the black, all the labels you can think of, right?
Yeah.
Because it affects everyone. If a man knows about a period, then he can help his daughter, his sister, his wife, his mother, his friend. The next generation boys, maybe we don't have to have PMS jokes because they understand it. Maybe we can create an army of empathetic men who are always going to be able to have that conversation without thinking that it's like a big, massive thing. Aaron, as you know, has gone through the sex education at school and he understands about periods because of the learnings that we've given him.
Yeah.
But when he did have his sex ed, he was, it was the last year of junior school.
Yeah.
He came home and he said, "Mummy, we had sex education today." Yeah. And I did the normal thing that every other parent does where my insides fell and I thought, "Oh my God, please don't ask me any questions." And then I said, "Oh, what happened then?" He said, "Well, they separated the girls and the boys. And they told the girls, if any of the boys ask, just say they're sweets, right?"
Okay.
This was only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. Can you believe that in the UK, that this is what's still happening in education? And then he said, "And Mummy, I think I probably need to use pads as well." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, we get wet dreams, don't we?" So my son, who knows everything about periods, was completely confused by the education that he was given at school.
Wow. So I can't even imagine someone who doesn't have a mother like you who's doing this kind of work. They would probably just come out completely dazed. Like,
Perhaps if I wasn't doing this work, I would be of the same thought that boys don't need to know about periods until much later. Because we protect our kids, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't want to tell my daughters about sex until they need to know, then I don't want to tell my boys either.
Yeah.
Right? So it comes from that. But if we can just clarify that periods has got nothing to do with sex, it's just a normal body process, then I think we're on to creating,
because I think it's really important that we, as you know, as I said before, to use this conversation to empower women, because I feel like having a period for those 4 or 5 days, for me at least, I feel quite, I would say, weak, in the sense that I'm tired or I'm in pain and I can't really do much. And it's like you know, some people see this as, you can say, a bit of a disability, in the sense that you can't perform your daily tasks like you normally would. And I think now the conversation has to be about empowering women, that it's okay to have a period, it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to tell people that I'm in pain, I don't want to do this and this and that.
But just think of, like, that's the primary reason why we started.
Yeah.
But essentially today, we know that because women are fearful of talking about their periods, they suffer for years with medical issues around periods. You know, they don't know that they've got PCOS or all of these things.
But then it also has an impact on their mental health as well.
Of course it does. And I know now in my life that every day my life is bothered by its hormone level. Like, my hormones play such a massive... My hormones. our hormones play such a massive part in our lives, and we just quietly suffer with them every day.
Mm.
And the only reason we do that is because we just don't know how to have that conversation.
Yeah. Because like, you can't go into work and say, I mean, I feel like when I'm at work and I'm in pain or whatever, I'm not feeling well, it's not, for me, it feels like it's not a valid excuse to say I'm on my period. But I think it should be, because if someone is suffering to whatever extent, whether it's a bit of cramps or to some degree, some women faint or some women vomit, I think it's really important to have that empowerment to say, actually, I cannot do this because I feel unwell.
It's about being truth and not being authentic, right? So if we can roll up to work on a Monday morning and we've had the heaviest drinking session the night before, it's hard to hide that from your face, despite any makeup.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people can see that there's something going on. When you're on your period and if you're suffering with pain, it's hard not to see it.
Mm.
But we're just, we've just been through COVID, right?
Yeah.
Lots of us have worked at home, and the world has still, life has still continued.
Yeah.
Now imagine, and we all accept today that we can work from home, or not everybody, but, you know, that there are jobs that you can do from home.
Yeah.
So what if, and we live in a man's world, I'm going to say that again, I love men, and I think men need to be included in every single conversation, but it's now time for us to show what we need.
Mm-hmm.
So we live in a man's world, we go to the office Monday to Friday, you know, 9 to 6 or whatever the timings are. And now through COVID, what if we were able to work from home once a month for a couple of days?
People realise it's not bad after all.
We could sit behind a Zoom and wear gym jams underneath and wear our shirt on top or whatever.
Yeah.
Life still works, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why do women have to continue to suffer? Why not have period policies at work
which
allow organisations to show that they value their employees, to have period products in the toilets? If you're not if you're not feeling well yourself, you're going to go home and make up the time. You're not going to just... There's always going to be people that take advantage, but for the majority of people, if we want to create change and take the women into an empowered world for the next decade, then let's start looking at these things.
Yeah.
It's not something that can't be achieved. Mm. I know, as you know, it takes one voice, right, to get it started.
Yeah. Well, I know, Manjeet, with Binti, you're working with schools, you're working with a lot of different people to try and bring these conversations about. But I think one of the conversations that struck me was when you went to Gurdwara and you said, why aren't women allowed to come in when they're menstruating?
Mm.
And I think that's really powerful because it's a narrative that I've been raising my whole life. And to some extent, even now, I have my own mandir at home. I have my own little temple where I pray every day. And when I am on my period, I am very conscious about that. Like, shall I go into this room or shall I not? It's because it's been digged into our heads for such a long time. But what you did was quite incredible, that you changed someone's mind. And that was one mind that you changed, and now this person is going to hopefully continue that narrative. So you've actually created a change that could last for not just decades, but hundreds of years now, and generations. And I think that's incredible. But how did you do that? Because we know that people in our society are very stuck in their ways, especially those who are in, you know, these positions where they are priests or working in temples or gurdwaras, because it's a narrative that's been sort of going on for generations before that. To change that now at this point, at this breaking point, you must have had to like really fight for it.
It's one of those things again, right? I learned on the job as I went along, right? So a conversation with my mother right at the beginning when I first went to India, I took her with me and I said, Mum, I'm going as a grown woman. I'm not going to sit in the village. I'm going to be doing my work. And if you want to come with me, you can. And she was like, okay. So I was allowed to have freedom, finally. I went and interviewed, I don't know how many girls. And I had these interviews in Punjabi when I came back.
Mm-hmm.
And I had them on my phone. So I gave them to my mum to listen to. And she listened to them, like 3 or 4 of them. And then she took the phone and she threw it across the manja. And she's like, why do you have to do such a dirty job? And I just laughed. I thought, oh my God, my mum, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know how deep it was, right? Then about 6 months later, she phoned me and she said that she was running a collection drive for some charity. and that she should put me down for £50 or something. Can she put me down for £50? And when your mum asks you something like that, you just say yes, yeah, and you let her do it, right? And then I said, but mum, you do know that I run a charity, don't you? She said, well, your women have rags. These people don't even have anything to eat. So I thought, okay, I'll leave it as that. Then 6 months later, I was due to go on Sikh Channel television show.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of going to my mum's the day before, as you do, because I went in a onesie. It was cold.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise that she had guests over.
Oh.
So I'm sitting there with my mum, and my mum says, she says, make sure when you go on television tomorrow, you wear proper clothes.
Yeah.
I said, mum, you're worried about what I'm going to wear. I'm worried how I'm going to speak to Uncle G. He's got a white beard and turban. How I'm going to speak to him about periods. And she says, don't you dare speak to him in Punjabi or about periods. You speak to the girl in English that's sitting with him.
Yeah.
And then this remarkable thing happened, because the very next day when I spoke to him, he said, well done for the work that you're doing. It's really important. It's about time that we started talking about these things in our community. And when I saw my mum next, you know, she had this, oh, my daughter, my daughter.
Ah, so now it changed.
It changed. And the reason it changed is because she saw someone that she respected clarify that this is important work. So for me, when I started trying to get the conversation into mandirs and into gurdwaras, I didn't even think that this was a problem in the Sikh religion, right? But it was, and I couldn't go and start stipulating what mandirs or mosques or churches should do until I had my own house in order. And it took me the longest time to find my hero, and it was Peter Verdi. Peter Verdi, who, you know, one of our ambassador patrons, he stood up and said, what do you mean women aren't allowed to do certain things when they're on their period? He told me that he has a little gurdwara in his house, and that his wife told him that his cleaner refused to clean that area because she was on her period.
Oh.
And he was really, because he didn't really, I don't think in the beginning when I first met him, really he really understood the issue.
Yeah.
But after the conversation we had and then the subsequent conversations we had in the gurdwara and stuff, he could see that this was massive.
Yeah.
And to be honest, he can talk about periods in Punjabi much better than I can, or any woman that I've ever heard can.
Yeah.
And it was with his support and with the committee, Gurpreet, the nun, another man, who stood up and says, no, this can't be the case that women don't have access, that they said, yes, let's get this into our gurdwara. And then I remember a few weeks later, as we were planning for it, I spoke to the gyani, the priest.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting conversation, because I was terrified. And every time I've spoken to a man that I, in a certain sector that I haven't spoken to before, I have this nervous feeling inside, like, what am I going to say? How am I going to say it? What's he going to think? So I remember speaking to him, and I was speaking in Punjabi again, and I said, he said, yes, but I'm not sure that I agree that women should sit and do seva behind Maharaj's beard, because what if they are on their period and they leave a stain? I said, that's right, you know, it is something to be concerned about. I said, but what about men who might sit there and fart, or might pick their nose, or they might have dirty feet, or they have bad thoughts in their head?
Yeah.
You know, how does that work against someone who's really trying, a woman who might really be trying? And I think, I don't know what I did, but I managed to press those buttons with him. And he understood exactly what I was saying.
Mm.
And then when we launched the period policy, we did this massive campaign, video campaign. It went all the way to India, and it was like, you know, it really did well. This conversation that we had with the gyani afterwards, just to stipulate why he did it and how he did it and the importance of it. Like, he is the most eloquent, this conversation. No, I couldn't even imagine. I even remember being in the gurdwara and standing at the podium to talk about the campaign, and I was thinking, oh my God, I'm in a gurdwara. I'm about to talk about periods. Yeah. How am I going to do it? And I'm pretty sure my voice must have sounded even quieter than it does normally. Yeah. But I did it. And I guess that for me was quite a massive thing.
Yeah. It's to sort of break that obstacle in front and crash it, and then you're free to carry on and have these conversations as you go ahead.
It's our own stuff as well, isn't it? You know, like
it's all—it's all in our own heads.
Yeah. No one cares really.
Yeah,
it's we think that they care or that they're going to judge us, and but when you stop judging yourself, then it's just a lot easier.
What's been the biggest challenge you faced?
To be fair, I don't really see challenges.
Of course you don't, Manjeet.
That's the honest truth. Like, if I'm disheartened, you know, I might have a rubbish day at work.
Yeah.
I'm really fortunate something mad happens. Right, if I say, oh God, I don't think I can do this anymore. Why am I doing this? Why don't I go and get a proper job or something?
Yeah.
Then something stupid like an 81-year-old woman will call me up and say, I'd like to give you £10. I'm just waiting for my pension to come in.
Oh.
Yeah, crazy things like that.
Yeah.
And then you think, how? How
well,
did this woman?
I think you hit this sort of moment as well when COVID hit. I remember talking to you on the phone and you were like, Meenal, I don't really know what to do now. I mean, how can we help? And I think that's what your narrative has always been, Manjeet, in your head, that how can I help? It's not a case of, oh, but people aren't listening to me, or but this might not work, that. You always want to help and always want to be, you always want to get your hands dirty.
Mm.
And this is why I love working with you and talking to you, because this is what we need now. We need people to get their hands dirty, whether it affects them directly or not, whether we're talking about periods, whether we're talking about protective gear for doctors or healthcare workers. Everybody needs to get their hands dirty now, because we all need to create a change. And we discussed over the phone that maybe masks could be something that we could help our communities with. And it was funny, because at that time, no one was talking about public face masks. But I said to you, I remember saying that, look, I think there's going to be a point where people will need it, because hospitals are running out, and the community at some point when they start going out, they will need masks. So we spoke about it, and then you found a solution, because a lot of charities have been affected by the pandemic. You've had to stop going to schools, doing your traveling. So what was it like to sort of switch your, you know, from going to making menstrual products to making masks?
Well, last year we set up this sewing club in local to me, where we had about 16 women. And then the numbers changed. But these old women, they didn't have, I'd hate using that term, old women, but they're like my grannies, right?
Yeah.
That age.
Yeah.
And they would meet every Monday. We had donated fabric from Abel and Cole, this fantastic company. We've got Garage Full. And the idea was that we would make stuff with them. We started with making tote bags, which we could sell, because we thought, you know, this will help us to generate some cash. And then, because we wanted to bring something back to the people that we were working with, we made period bags. And these period bags are designed for girls to put period products in schools.
Yeah.
So we already had this up and running. And then after that conversation, and this was just maybe 2 days before the lockdown kicked in.
Yeah.
Like really early, right? I spoke to the women. They were beginning to shut down the sewing club where they were working. But we put together a pattern. I found a pattern in Wuhan, right? And the idea was to put a pad liner in the mask so that we could have extra protection. And they started sewing these masks. And if you think about when in the 70s, my mum, she used to sew things for CNA and all of those guys from home. And what they would do is they'd have different parts of the process and drop different bits to
like
people.
A factory line sort of thing. Yeah,
but different people, right?
Yeah,
so you're the first person would cut, the second person would iron, the third person would sew the handle, and then they would. So these women, what we did was, they live in a place called Whiteley Village, and it's like a big social housing compound. There's about 450 people that live there. My sewing club, bless them, they would take one bit of the process once they finished, they'd put that in a bag and they would leave it outside the next person's house. And then that person would leave it outside the next person's house. And this was during lockdown, so they weren't allowed to go anywhere, right? No, nobody was coming into the house or anything. And it was the most amazing thing. I had them in a WhatsApp group. We were speaking every day. They would talk about the different fabric they used or the colour, the new style that they put. We went from having straps and then having the elastic.
Yeah.
And they were so happy that they were able to impact the lives of people in their community.
Yeah. Right. I remember we used our masks for your masks, or our masks, Binti masks, for our protests as well.
And imagine that, right? So these women are sewing these masks, and suddenly it's on their masks on the front pages. They were so proud of them. I mean, they're all proud of you, but they were so proud of themselves.
Yeah.
Because.
But I was so happy to involve them, and I think that was the great thing about it. At a time where elderly people and vulnerable people were scared what was going to happen over the next few months, because obviously sitting at home is not healthy for anybody, but to give them this task to help society and to help our community was an incredible thing. And I remember meeting Sue the day of the second protest, and she was just so happy to meet us as doctors and say, look, here are our masks.
It was just, it really was one of those things where I actually thought everything that I'd done in my life was about that moment. About getting these women to sew masks, because if they weren't doing anything during lockdown, there would have been a lot of unhappiness.
Of course, yeah.
Right, so they would get out of bed. They went from sewing 2 hours a week to sewing every day, seven days, you know.
Yeah.
That's how crazy it was.
So Manjeet, I mean, I could go on forever talking to you, and I know there's a lot more you want to do with Binti, but I have a question for you that I've been thinking about for a long time, because obviously what I'm doing with doctors in protective gear is, for me, it's really important to stick at a grassroots level, right? Obviously, we need political changes to be implemented to create the change that we want to see. But it's very easy to sort of lose your way as you go along and sort of say, okay, but if I change my stance as someone from a charitable organization, then maybe I can make more change by going into politics or by going into Number 10 or into Downing Street. And I know that's something that you've looked into as well, but how do you keep everything apolitical and make sure that everybody in the community understands what you're doing and you stick to that? Because I know that once you get into politics, things can get very, very tricky and you would lose your connection to what you wanted to start with from the beginning. So how do you stick to keeping everything at a grassroots level?
See, it's about decorum, dignity, and language. Your language is the same. Your language, you decide what the language is, and it should be the same despite any political conversation. You know, the conversation you have about what you're doing is designed for your audience so that they understand and they're going to create change. So it's that. And then my tagline, every girl deserves dignity, period. If anything that I'm doing doesn't affect that, then I'm off track and I need to go back on track.
So that's what keeps you grounded, going back to
that one line.
To these things. And my last question, Manjeet, for you is, where do you see yourself in the next 10 years?
When I grow up, I just want to be like you.
Well, when I grow up, I want to be like you, Manjeet. Well, thank you for joining me today, Manjeet. I really appreciate you coming down, and there's so much more I would like to talk to you about, but I think we'll have to leave it at that for now. I mean, hopefully next time we can talk about everything else, and maybe we'll be traveling around the world soon together with baby Radhika as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the dream.
Yeah, that's it. let's expand it.
Yeah. Thank you, Manjeet.
Thank you.